Greetings, everyone. This is Jonathan Alexander. I'm editor of College Composition and Communication, and I'm here today with Kelly Ritter, who is the author of With Increased Dignity and Importance, Rehistoricizing Charles Roberts and the Illinois Decision of 1955. Joining us also is Jens Lloyd, who is the editorial assistant for the journal. Kelly, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm really excited about this piece, and again, everything you do with history in the field is so groundbreaking. Tell us a little bit about this article and how you came to write it.
Well, thank you for saying that my work is groundbreaking. Put that on a book jacket somewhere. But thank you. Well, as you probably know from some of the other things that I've done, I'm very interested in local histories. And so I didn't plan to write a local history when I came to Illinois, but when I just finished being rhetoric director. I served for 4 years and now I'm an associate dean. But when I was rhetoric director, I was pointed toward a closet one day that our secretary said, "So pretty soon they're going to do construction in here. I thought you should know about this closet of stuff." So she opens up the door and it's just filled top to bottom with stuff. And some of the stuff are papers from the director of rhetoric, Charles Roberts, who served, as you know, from the article from the 30s to about 1960, who was also, of course, the first editor of C's. And there were lots of things in there that were unbeknownst to the English department archive, the university archive, anything. So I started just looking through them and finding a lot of interesting information that I hope I'll be able to use for maybe another article someday. But as I was looking through it, I was realizing that there were things that were related to what I had known as a basic writing scholar as the Illinois Decision. And I started realizing, oh, there's something going on in these archives that maybe I didn't really know or understand. And so just the more I looked through them, I had a graduate student, Kirsten Dean, I'm going to shout out to her in case she listens, who helped me clean out this closet one day, which is very messy and dirty. And sort of got down to the elemental things that I thought were important that I could save. And in those, there was some correspondence about what happened when they got rid of their basic writing program. And so, as with most of my local archival work, I realized there was a story that had not been told. And so I wanted to tell it. And I also felt weirdly responsible for telling it because I was the director now. He had been the director many years ago. And all these years in between us, nobody had told this story. So I had kind of a weird personal feeling of responsibility to this person that I'd never met and who I think might have been actually very unpleasant in real life. But he had an interesting backstory. And so I thought I should tell it. So that's how it got started.
It's delightfully chironic in that sense. And talk about being in the right place, the right time. You literally took this history out of the closet.
So, yes, very much so. Yes.
Where are the papers now? Were you able to house them in the Illinois Library or?
Well, you know, that's sort of a bad story because I didn't ever really follow through with the archivist here. And a lot of the things that I actually ended up using for the article are in the archive. So, you know, if you look at the works cited, you'll see that most of what I'm actually citing ends up being things that were in the Senate committees or in the department files. Although his personnel file went missing, so I couldn't look at that, which is another odd story. So the things that I kept were sort of a scattering of things that he had kept over the years, and some of them were sort of official and some were unofficial. And to be honest, they're at my house because my grad student and I decided, well, you know, we're just going to keep these things safe for the moment. But at some point, if I were a responsible human being, I would turn them over to the university archivist. And I'm really sorry if she's listening right now. But some of it was duplicative stuff too. So yes, this is a long way of saying they're at my house.
I love it. What would you hope that a reader of this article, kind of thinking with you about this history, what would you hope that a faculty member, a scholar, a teacher of basic writing would say?
Oh, well, I think that, so as I foregrounded in the introduction, there's a kind of narrative, I think, among scholars of basic writing about the Illinois Decision, that it was very, it was draconian, and it was groundbreaking in a negative way because, of course, as the article in Seas outlines, all these other folks started to do it too. But I knew from history that I had done on Harvard and Yale that when a prominent institution did something, you know, first part of the century in terms of particularly English and writing programs, or at least that's all I know about it, that's my research, other institutions would follow, you know, so it was sort of like, well, you got a good idea, let me try that too. So Illinois was in that position, so a lot of people followed suit. But what I think I'd like for people to take away from the article is that it wasn't as simple as that. So there were good and bad reasons for this to have happened, and most important, I think, is for readers to not necessarily come away with from the article saying, oh, that Charles Roberts, he was actually a really good guy. Because like I said, I'm not actually sure that's true. You know, he's a complicated person. But to understand that when these sorts of things happen, that they rarely are something that one does by themselves or because they themselves wanted to. There's a lot of complicated things that happened behind the scenes that led to this. And the reasons he had for doing it were not necessarily the reasons that other people wanted it to happen, but they ended up converging, you know. And I guess the secondary thing that I would want readers to know out of this is, I think it could be useful for people who are trying to get smaller or more fine-grained portraits of WPA work. I mean, certainly Barb and Lisa and others have done that kind of work previously. It's not like this is the first time, but to be able to say, well, here's somebody who was fairly prominent for a few years in the field, being in your shoes, of course, you know, 65 some years ago. And this is what it was like to be a WPA before we called it a WPA, right? So I think adding to those stories is always useful for people who are trying to historicize the field. And then there's this little kind of sidebar in there about Gerber, which probably should be another article of its own, but how sort of prominent field figures were interacting around these key issues. I think that we think of these as policy decisions, but we don't think of these as personal problems or predilections. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. No, what you're arguing is so important. And I know that in your own work as a WPA, certainly in my work as a WPA, whatever our quote-unquote stature might be in a larger field, the particular institutional context in which you work is always so much more complicated. And your decisions or things that are done about writing on a campus are rarely the result of an individual. You know, they're often extremely complex negotiations.
Yes.
That look simple from outside, but upon closer inspection are dense and often very vexed. So,
and something I should add to that is in the article, readers will see how much Roberts interacted with high school teachers in Illinois. I mean, he was the editor of the Illinois English Bulletin, you know, for years. He was very much in communication with high school teachers, which is not something we always have the privilege to be able to do now. But I think it was the most interesting thing for me was to read through the individual letters that the high school teachers sent back in response to the writing guide saying, no more of this, no less of this. And, you know, people's needs don't really change. They haven't really changed very much.
Isn't that interesting?
But that whole aspect of the decision was never easily apparent to me when I had criticized it previously in my earlier work and when a lot of people, you know, have been critical of it, which makes sense. So I thought the idea of what it is that we could gain or you know, theoretically gain from being able to work with secondary school teachers was important to bring to the surface too.
Wonderful. Good. Jens?
Well, Kelly, I want to get back to the rhetoric closet because it was certainly a fascinating aspect of reading this article. But I'm particularly wondering, I mean, as someone who's done archival research and written about doing archival research, what you would say to the kind of budding archival researcher who's standing in front of maybe that, you know, closet of stuff at their own institution, kind of approaching these sorts of materials to do these local histories. You know, I mean, is it something where you go in with a set of questions or particular interests? Is it that you just simply read all the stuff and kind of stuff emerges from the stuff? You know, maybe some advice for the archival researchers out there.
No, that's a good question. I think that there's a lot of serendipity, obviously, in archival work. I think that I guess I would say almost every time I've started an archival project, it's been, I have an interesting bit of stuff here to look at, or I have a question and I'm not sure if this pile of archival materials will answer it or not, or if I need to look at a different pile, right? And then the pile of materials poses a different question that I need to answer. And so when I came to this, the closet, as it shall be known, I was just really excited that I found things that people hadn't paid any attention to. I was surprised that they were not completely disintegrating. And I just wanted to see what was there. And a lot of it was not very useful. It was sort of, you know, many, many copies of this journal or that journal. And, you know, so I think for me, it was very interesting, but not very difficult in an intellectual sense to go through and go, that's worth saving, that's not. And that's what Kirsten and I did. We spent a whole day going, save this, trash that, save this, you know, and trying to figure out what was actually going to be useful. But it takes a lot of mental energy, right, to make those decisions and to decide how much of it you're going to cart back to your house and, you know, how careful you need to be. And there's sorts of issues with handling it, you know, too. But I think if I were younger and newer to this, probably the first thing I would have advised someone to do is to call my archivist and say, can you please come over here now and take a look at this with me? Because I don't want to do something stupid. And in fact, I may have done something stupid. I may have thrown away something that I should have kept. But I know there's a memo from 1920 that preceded him in there on onion skin paper that I saved because I thought, I don't even care what's on this. It's from 1920. I'm going to save it, right? An archivist, though, could help you figure out, well, there's four of those, you know, copies of that somewhere else. I think that what this closet was whenever he decided to retire, he just took some stuff home and the stuff he didn't take home probably went in a closet and it's literally been there for 50 some years. And since he died right after he retired and didn't have any heirs, you know, probably just nobody came back looking for it. Right. I don't know if that's very good advice. I think my best advice is for people to be curious and to make sure that they have enough energy to keep the hunt going, right? If you get very deep into a set of archival materials and you're bored, then you're probably not on the project that you should be on, right? Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. Don't be bored.
Yeah. Well, if you're bored, then it's probably, that's not the project. You know, if you're not, what do I used to tell my grad students? If it doesn't make you angry or it doesn't keep you awake at night, it's probably not a project worth doing, right? And this kept me awake at night for the better part of a year. So I guess it was worth doing.
Totally worth it. Absolutely. We've been talking with Kelly Ritter and about her article, With Increased Dignity and Importance, Rehistoricizing Charles Roberts and the Illinois Decision of 1955. You can read it in the February issue of CCC. Kelly, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.